We're wrapping up. We usually try to do a message on Christian stewardship and on giving towards the beginning of every year. We do our annual business meeting at the end of February, so usually it falls around March. And so, so we're wrapping up a little mini series, a little three-part series, as we're kind of getting underway for our year here in 2024. So I'm doing what's called Tithing Part 2. Tithing Part 1 was 2 weeks ago, and then a week prior to that, we did the opening of this sermon series called A Sacred Sacrifice. And so each week I've kind of picked a word. I grew up in the South, and my accent is still present sometimes, but not always. When I went away to college, I grew up in Verina, which is eastern Henrico County farm country. I didn't know that I talked differently. But when you get into an environment where most of the people are from other parts of the U.S., especially from up north, and you are the object of ridicule, right? So, you know, I was Mom and Diddy, 50 Cent, Saturday, and that's just how we talked growing up, right? And Vanessa's like, please don't, you know, repeat those words like that. You're making me nervous. And I'm like, no, this is right. This is how I talked growing up. And then I had to learn how to work that out of my accent. And but then there's just some words that still come back. And this is one of them for me. I remember I like to do a lot of our own vehicle maintenance. And I remember early on in a marriage, I told Vanessa, I'm going to go change the oil in the car. And she said, you're going to change what in the car? I said, the oil. And she said, I don't know what that is. I said, you know, motor oil. And she says, yeah, I still don't know what that is. And she said, you mean oil? And I said, yeah, that's what I said. Oil. And it's just one long syllable, as most things are in the South. Anybody else have a oil word? Yeah, thank you. Now, what's funny about me is I don't say it that way when I'm referring to other things. Like we do anointing oil. Right, we have anointing oil that we use when we pray for people. We had this sweet moment right before we walked out for the wedding. It was me, my brother, and Ethan, the Misho men, and Pastor David and Derek. We prayed together. I had my dad's Bible there, and I anointed him with oil. Right, and so it's funny, like when you say certain words in a certain way in a certain context, right? And but for me, for cars, it's still oil, and it's always going to be, right? It's always going to be that. And so each week we've had some fun, right, picking a word that maybe I say a little differently, or Vanessa, like a couple of weeks ago, a name that she says. And we've been having fun with that because it reminds us that when I live my life, especially my financial life, our actions, they say something. And the question that we're asking ourselves is, are we mispronouncing Christian stewardship by the way we're living our lives? Specifically, when God listens to how I manage my money, am I mispronouncing Christian stewardship, right? It's like when you heard me say that word, right, there's something inside of you that says, I don't think you're saying that right, Fred. And we're asking the question, when God listens to us, when he's observing how we're managing our money, is something in God saying, you know, I don't think you're saying that right through the way that you're managing your money, your household finances. We've called this little mini-series A Sacred Sacrifice because those two words are significant. One is when we are practicing Christian stewardship the way that we're supposed to, there should be sacrificial generosity that's flowing from our lives, meaning that not just with what's left over, but that we should feel it. The way that we give and how we give and the amount we give, it should affect us. I would argue it should alter our standard of living. It should be sacrificial in nature. And then part of that generosity should be flowing towards the church that we call home, which enters into the sacred part. Meaning that one of the reasons why Jesus said he came was to build his church. And so there's a sacredness to that mission because it's the mission that Jesus said he came to do. This is the thought I've been throwing out every week. Am I giving sacrificially to the sacred work of building Jesus' church? Because if I'm not giving sacrificially to the sacred work of building Jesus' church, then I am mispronouncing Christian stewardship by the way I'm managing my money. And so I've been throwing this slide up each week to challenge you. If you call this your church home, now if this isn't the church that you call home, then this slide, is it up there? Do you have it? It says the four blanks on there. There it is. Is that whatever church that you call home, you should have a sheet like this. Now, depending on your church and what they're doing and how they give to missions and if they're raising any money, then you might have less blanks, you might have more blanks. But there should be something at the beginning of every year that you're asking yourself. When you look at your family budget, your household finances, you should have something that you're filling in for these blanks. For our family, for us, We have 10% of our gross annual income that we give to the church. And then beyond that, we have what's called a missions commitment. It's a budgeted number. It's a number that we say we're going to give this amount every month to missions. Missions here at City Life Church goes out the door. 100% of all the money that's earmarked as missions does not stay with us. That's why we like to say all of us should give both to and through the church that we call home. Then we have something we call a missions pledge that's been a part of our church for over 10 years. A lot of churches call it a faith promise. It's that you pray and God gives you a number and you're not budgeting for it. You just believe by faith that it's going to come and he's going to provide it. And every year, people have these incredible stories about how money they did not expect comes in, and then we give that money also to missions. And so we have a figure that we've set aside for that as a family. That's a missions pledge. And then usually those are our only three. Those are our only three fill in the blanks that we have as a church family. But this year we have a legacy offering that we are trying to raise money for. If you're new to our church, we have an incredible story. This property was donated to us in 2019. It's an incredible story. It's miraculous. It came to us debt-free, but it's not expense-free, right? And so it's our turn to steward this property for the other churches that partner with us here. But not just steward it for us for now, it's to steward it for future generations, right? There, a church planted here in the 50s, and we're here because they gave and they sacrificed. And one day when we're gone, we want our children and our children's children to have a place where they come, that this has been set aside as sacred soil for a sacred work. And so we take seriously this responsibility that we have to take care of this facility. We have about $130,000 worth of projects that we need to do in this building, and we're going to move forward with that with cash reserves, but then we're trying to raise $40,000 over the next 6 months to help replenish those cash reserves. And so we're asking, if you call this your church home, that you're going to have a fourth fill in the blank that you're going to do there for the legacy offering to help replenish those cash reserves. And again, we're going to try to raise that over the next 6 months. One of them is the air conditioning unit for this space. So unless you want to have a sweaty summer, then we're going to inspire you. I keep telling the leadership team, just one of these days, I'm going to crank the heat up to about 90 for a Saturday service and create an experiential moment, right, for our church. So I joke, this church has such a history of generosity. Anytime we've ever been in a place where we've had to raise money, the money always comes in. It always comes in. And so we have no doubt that the heart of generosity in this church is going to continue to move. So we're tonight going to do three of the last six questions that in 25 years of pastoral ministry, I tend to get six common questions or six themes that come up when we talk about the biblical concept of tithing. 2 weeks ago, we did the portion, the consequence, and the priority. And then tonight, we're going to do the place, the offerings, and the trust. The place, the offerings, and the trust. I want to point back to the consequence piece, though, because 2 weeks ago, you know, the language of Malachi sometimes can be off-putting because it talks about blessing and cursing. And so we modernized that a little bit and said, you know, really what God's saying is when we do things his way, there's always ultimately more. But when we do things our way, there's always ultimately less. Even though it might feel like more in the moment, it ends up being less. And even though it might feel like less in the moment, it ends up being more. And this is part of practicing generosity on the scale that God asks us. So let's talk about the place a little bit tonight. the place and why we believe that for the person who is a devoted follower of Christ, why giving starts in the church they call home, why it starts with the congregation that they are a part. There's a verse that's going to pop up on the screen. It's Joshua 13, 14. It says, Moses did not assign any allotment of land to the tribe of Levi. Instead, as the Lord had promised them, their allotment came from their offerings burned on the altar to the Lord, the God of Israel. Now, when you look at a map, if you've got a paper Bible or if even if you're online and you're looking at a map of Israel during biblical times, especially Old Testament times, you're eventually going to come across a map that shows the allotment of the lands that were portioned out based on the 12 tribes of Israel. And when you're looking at that, you will see that the tribe of Levi was not given an allotment of land. If you are also astute, who are my Bible people in here, one of the other 12 sons of Jacob is you don't see his name. Which name is that? Yes, thank you, Brentley. Come on. See, student ministries representing student ministry. Yeah, and so Joseph, it's because there was an ancient practice where sometimes a father will take his grandchildren as his own sons. We're not going to try to bring that practice back and to stir up any family trouble. But Jacob did that. Joseph had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And so when you look at that map, you don't see Joseph's name, but you see Manasseh and Ephraim. But then you see that the tribe of Levi was omitted. And as you read through the Old Testament, what you see is that this tribe had a sacred duty to be the priests of a nation. Now, they were allotted some cities. They were had places to live. But there was not a land that was apportioned to them. And what we teach and what I have taught for a long time is that I believe not only was that part of the history of Israel, but that God was creating a prophetic picture for every society as it moves forward throughout time in the future. That every community needs a group of people that are set apart for the spiritual well-being of that community. Let me say that again. That every city, every town, every place, every geographic region needs people that are set apart who are tasked with the responsibility of the spiritual well-being of that community. And part of what makes that possible is the giving of the people that live there, so that pastors and ministers are accessible and available to people. It's a beautiful thing, isn't it, that when you read through the story of the Old Testament, you find that there were people that were always readily available for God in worship, but also for people in ministry. And it's not a coincidence and an accident that when we pick up with the book of Acts, and then you continue on with the epistles, is that you find the first century church continued this practice. And the first century church continued this practice because as they looked back into the Old Testament, I think they saw it as a prophetic picture too. It was understood that the nation of Israel would collectively support the work of the ministry as well as those tasked with doing that ministry. And at the inception of the church in Acts, we find a continuation of a commitment to the collective financial support of the ministry of their home church. Our baseline giving should start with the church that we call home. Communities still need pastors and mentors, pastors and clergy today for the work of mentoring, for the work of counseling, for the work of crisis intervention, for the work of teaching and instruction, is that it's a beautiful thing for communities to have clergy. And so churches like ours, we're grateful to be able to do that. So I still believe that the place where tithing starts is in the church that we call home. All right, somebody say the offerings. So the offerings. So when you dig around in the Bible, what you find is that there are other ways that the nation of Israel, and then as you continue into the New Testament, were inspired to give, not just so that there could be clergy, not just so that there could be ministers, but there were resources that were set aside for the care of others. These verses are going to pop up on the screen, and then I'm going to read them for you. This is in Proverbs 28, 27. It says, "Whoever gives to the poor will lack nothing, but those who close their eyes to poverty will be cursed." I love there's another verse in Proverbs that says, "When you give to the poor, you lend to the Lord." That's powerful, isn't it? So you find this practice, this biblical instruction that there are people in society who lack, and then those of us who have means should carry with us a sense of responsibility to provide for them. And we want to be that kind of church. The second one is this, for hospitality. So you find that there's a outflow of generosity from the church for people who are under-resourced. But then you find that, too, that there's an outflow of generosity from the church for the purpose of hospitality. Leviticus 19, 9 through 10 reads this way, "When you harvest the crops of your land, do not harvest the grain along the edges of your fields. Do not pick up what the harvesters drop. It's the same with your grape crop. Do not strip every last bunch of grapes from the vines. Do not pick up the grapes that fall on the ground. Leave them for the poor." And listen to what it says also. "And the foreigners living among you, I am the Lord your God." Right? There, when you read the Bible, there wasn't a Wawa in the Old Testament. You with me? When people were traveling, they were at the mercy of the generosity of the towns that they would pass through. Right? It was impossible for them to carry everything that they needed for long journeys. Right? And so God had told Israel, hey, your cultural practice is going to be that when people pass through this land, right, no matter what happens to them in their plight, when they come through here, they are going to be sustained because of the generosity of our people. That as they pass through your fields. Now, you got to believe that there were landowners who were looking out onto that field and calculating, right? With this extra grain, I could get that donkey I've been eyeing at the marketplace. You tracking with me? The grapes, they're like, if we could take those grapes and make a little bit more wine, just think about what we could buy. You got to believe that they were saying, if we could harvest that amount of grain, then what we could sell it, just think we could finally put that addition onto the house that we were hoping for, right? That there is a practice of generosity that is sacrificial to the point that we feel it. And what was set aside here by way of instruction for the Jewish people, God is saying, hey, there is a prize that is not material that you will experience when you step into this place of generosity that he has called us to. Having a sense of responsibility for the poor, having a sense of hospitality, even for people that we do not know, even for people who are strangers. In Exodus 36, 3 through 7, most of the time these verses are never read in the church because it's the story where people gave so much they had to tell them to stop giving. You with me? It's incredible. It says, Moses gave them the materials donated by the people of Israel as sacred offerings for the completion of the sanctuary. But the people continued to bring additional gifts each morning. Finally, the craftsmen who were working on the sanctuary left their work. Listen to this. They went to Moses and reported, "The people have given more than enough materials to complete the job the Lord has commanded us." So Moses gave the command, and this message was sent all throughout the camp. Men and women, stop giving. Which a pastor has said nowhere at any time. Right? If we get to $40,000 sooner than we're supposed to, right, I'm going to be there with the governance team. Do we really have to tell them we've already reached it? What if we just wait till the end of 6 months just to see? No, I'm just kidding. No, right? We wouldn't be that kind of church that says, hey, great, stop already. Stop already. There's more than enough. They were inspired to build the things that God had stirred their hearts to build, not just for their generation, but for the generations that were to come. Romans 15, 25 to 26, you see this practice, right, of offerings for missions, for spreading the gospel. says, but therefore I come, before I come, I must go to Jerusalem and take a gift to the believers there. For you see, the believers in Macedonia and Achaia have eagerly taken up an offering for the poor among the believers in Jerusalem. Meaning that churches in this place over here were giving to this church and this place over there. Right, there is the work of missions that we are enjoined to, this idea of giving to our church, but also giving through our church. And in the work of missions that happens here, once a quarter we throw that list up, and it's almost $2,000 flowing out of this church every single month to support missionaries, missions organizations, times where we've raised money for churches around the world for things that they've needed to do, and then how this church has always stepped up to answer that call. We're grateful. So there's a tithe, but then there is an offering, right? We joke that when in the Lord's Prayer where it says, Lord, give us this day our daily bread, it's not so we can eat the whole loaf, right? There's supposed to be a portion of what is given to us that we set aside for others. And sometimes what is set aside is predetermined. But then there should also be, I would argue, margins in our resources that's not predetermined and that's just set aside and is there for spontaneous moments of generosity as the Holy Spirit inspires our heart. So we did the place, we did the offerings. Now let's do the last one. It's called the trust, right? Because all of this that we've been talking about over the last few weeks in this little mini-series of Sacred Sacrifice, it hinges on trust. It hinges on faith. It hinges on this place of believing God, even when the math doesn't seem to make sense. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, love this verse. Look at this verse. It says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not depend on your own understanding. There's another translation that renders it, do not lean on your own understanding, right? That's a good imagery, right? This idea of when you lean on something. He's saying don't lean on your own understanding. Put the full weight of your life on him. It says, seek his will in all you do, and he will show you which path to take. There is a trust element to our relationship with our Father, especially with our resources. I'll share this story. I remember it was a couple of years ago, and we were in the midst of COVID and then some of the social unrest and that had been happening. And like a lot of churches, the dynamic of the church had changed. The giving was not there. People, right, were experiencing their own financial crisis, and so I remember we were putting together the budget for the coming year. I had such a sense that God spoke to me and said, Fred, I want you to set, I'm going to share with you the number because I want you to appreciate the magnitude of what God did. Is that he said, I want you to set aside $6,000 of your salary. When you meet with the governance team, I want you to tell them that you want it for a year. You want to set, and that's a lot of money for us as a family. It's a substantial percentage of our income. And so when I met with the governance team, I love Chuck and Penny aren't here. Chuck was like, we're not doing that. And you want friends that love you enough to say, yeah, we're not doing that, you know. And so I'm telling the story about how I was in a place of prayer. I've never heard God's voice, but I feel his voice. And I said, you cannot do it, right? I'm in a permission-giving relationship with the governance team. But I said, if you don't do it, I'm just going to turn around and give that money back because I know that I'm operating. This is a divine mandate. I'm supposed to set this money aside. I don't understand it. I don't know why, but I know I need to do it out of obedience. And so we met and we prayed. And at the end of that meeting, we said, okay, we're going to do it. And I kid you not, within that same month, we got a letter from our health insurance company with a check in it. And it was just over $6,000, almost to the penny, right? And we, in that moment, we opened up and you look at it, you're like, what? You know, because the number was almost exactly the amount that God had asked us to set aside. And so we still set aside that money from the church, but then we put that in a savings account and then we drew from that, right? Through our pay cycle. And I'm telling you that because part of this journey is that sometimes God's going to ask you to do some things. There is a fine line between faith and foolishness, right? And we never want anybody to be foolish as in their efforts, right? Sometimes people, they do foolish things because they're trying to get God's attention, and that's not how he operates with us. But there are times where he asks us to do things that require faith, and that you've got to have people in your life that you can go to and tell that story to, and you want their heart to bear witness to what you feel like as God is saying to you. And that's one of the guardrails that helps protect you between faith and foolishness. Does that make sense? You've got to have people that you trust, especially when you're in that gray area where it's hard to discern, is this faith or is this foolishness? You want people who can stand with you and say, no, I think this is the word of the Lord for your life too. What a moment that was for us as a family. What a moment that was for our children, right? To see that we felt like God was asking us to do something, and then how almost immediately God says, right? It was like God was saying, that check was going to come to us no matter what. You with me? But the story that it created, the faith story that created for our family, the faith inheritance that we're able to impart to our children in that moment, because they knew we had taken that step of faith and obedience and then see God come through. 2 Kings 4, love this story in the Bible. One day a widow of a member of the group of prophets came to Elisha and cried out, "My husband who served you was dead. And you know how he feared the Lord, but now a creditor has come, threatening to take my two sons as slaves. What can I do to help?" Elisha asked. "Tell me, what do you have in the house?" "Nothing at all, except a flask of oil. She said. And Elisha said, borrow as many empty jars as you can from your friends and your neighbors. And then go into your house with your sons and shut the door behind you and pour olive oil from your flask into the jars, setting each one aside when it is filled." You see the picture here, right? A flask is not very big. They have this small little container of olive oil, and they've gathered all these pots. I get this picture. There's just pots and jars everywhere. It's like when I was growing up in the country, we were on a well. We didn't have a city water, and so when the power would go out, we would not have water, right? Because there was a pump. And so whenever there was going to be a thunderstorm, we went around and we gathered we filled up pots full of water in the bathtub, and right? And every time I read this story, I think about growing up in Verina and walking into the kitchen and mom's got all these pots, right, filled with water. And there is this widow with her sons, and they're pouring from this little flask, right, which probably is not supposed to be enough oil to even coat the bottom of some of these jars that they've gathered. So she did as she was told. Her sons kept bringing jars to her. Can you imagine the feeling they had? They kept bringing jars to her. Soon every container.